Hey, everybody. Good morning. Great to see your smiling faces out there. It's wonderful. I have been on this bent for the last few weeks, as some of you might know, that I really want to see if we can get across to ourselves the monumental task it is to simply change the way that we think. It is the hardest thing in the world to do, to change what we'll call your worldview. You know what a worldview is? A worldview is just the way that you look at life. It's the way you look at existence. It's the way you look at reality. It has to do with the culture in which you were raised. It has to do with the house in which you grew up in, the church that taught you, the schools that taught you, the media that yells at you from every angle and every corner and orifice. I mean, you can't go into an elevator now without a screen or a gas pump without a screen. Everywhere you go, you are being input into from our culture and from our society, and all of that stuff is in there. All that stuff is captured, and all of that stuff makes up the way that you look at reality in your life and your spirituality and God, all of that stuff. It's the perfect prison because it doesn't look like it's a prison at all. It doesn't look like there's any need to escape from this. And yet, if we don't question the very ground on which we walk, the air that we breathe, we can never change the way that we think. And if we don't change the way that we think, we can't change our choices in life. And this is what it's all about. It's making different choices that will lead us to different experiences, that will lead us to the awareness of God in each moment. But it starts with a renewing of your mind, as Paul said. How do we do that? About 4 centuries before Jesus in China, there was a man named Chuang Tzu, and he wrote a wonderful little story. Lots of them, actually. But the one that I'm thinking of is called Autumn Floods. And it has to do with the river at the time of the autumn floods, where all the streams and the tributaries flow into this river until it widens and floods its bank. And the image is that from one side you can't tell a horse from a cow on the other side because the banks have grown so far apart. And the spirit of the river is laughing with joy as he flows eastward down his course, because he sees all things being gathered unto himself, and he just feels like he is the king of the world and the lord of the universe and all those sorts of things, until he flows into the North China Sea and he sees the vast and limitless horizon of this ocean. And he realizes what a fool he's been to think that his narrow banks had anything to do with the vastness that he sees before him. And he's lamenting about his foolishness. And the spirit of the ocean replies to him and says, "You cannot speak of ocean to a well frog, the creature of a narrower sphere. And you cannot speak of ice to a summer insect, the creature of a single season." Think about that for just a second. We are all well frogs. We are all little croakers down at the bottom of our wells, down at the bottom of our tubes, and our entire universe, our entire world, consists of the curved walls of that space and the little volume of water in which we swim. And we can look straight up and we can see a circle of light that alternates between brightness and darkness, and sometimes lights cross across our vision. And to that, to us, that is the entire universe. That is our world. We know nothing else. We have lived there all our lives. How can we possibly conceive of a world outside that world? That's our worldview. That's what it's like to be encased, you know, inside what we believe. The reality we believe is the reality we endure. We've said that several times in here. But I'd like to add one other concept to this. You cannot speak of perfect love to a human being, the creature of a broken heart. Think about that. Since we were very, very young and found out that the universe didn't revolve around us, that someone could say no to us, that we could have our wills frustrated, from that moment on, we have gotten increasingly broken hearts. And for some of us, our early memories are so traumatic, sometimes we can't even deal with them, we suppress them. But those hurts, that broken heart, creates so much of the worldview in which we swim. It creates the walls of our well. If you really think about it, what is the entire spiritual journey but to crawl up out of that space and see the next beyond, and then the next beyond after that, and after that, and after that? Do you think it ever ends? We are dealing with an infinite God, a God who will always surprise us at every turn, who always has something new for us. We will be falling into the center of His forever, forever. There will never be a time that we are finished, we are complete, that this is all there is. Because as soon as we flow into the ocean, we'll feel like fools to see the next vast horizon and area. I had a person that came to me very distraught that wanted to talk about a marriage situation. And it struck me because as we were talking about the situation, she kept saying, "Is it right to feel that way? Is it wrong to do this? You know, is it right for me to, you know, whatever it happened to be, is it right? Is it wrong?" And finally I stopped her and said, "You know what? It might be more helpful to stop thinking in terms of right and wrong and start thinking in terms of what works and what doesn't work." Now, I don't know how that sounds to you, you know, because this bumps right up against our worldview when it comes to the law, when it comes to legal things, when it comes to following the rules. But what are the rules really about? If something works, if something is functional, if something takes us into closer relationship with each other, knits things together, knits families together, well, then it's good. Then it's right. And if it doesn't, then it's not good. And it's not right. But to think of rightness and wrongness against some sort of standard out there that we can tack on the wall, as if we don't do what's right, then there's another black check against our name, That in some way, and here was the subtext, here was what she was really saying. If I don't do what's right, then God won't bless me. If I don't do what's right, then I will be forever frustrated by God. See, that's what we think. And however many times that we say this to ourselves, never underestimate the worldview and how deep it goes and how much it colors everything that you think and do. Because I guarantee you, we can say right now, that's not the way God works. That's not the way the law works. But in the next breath, we're going to be feeling that way. Because our feelings don't change until we have made thought changes and choice changes long enough to change our actual habits. And then our feelings can follow. But a lot of the anxiety that undergirds all that we experience and all that we express comes from the fear of not being acceptable to God. And so we got to take this thing apart and find out, what is it about this law? What is it about these rules that I've been taught all my life that I had to follow in order to be in God's good graces, in order to be able to be blessed, be successful in life, and ultimately to even enter heaven at all? I mean, what's this all about? And so we have Jesus saying to us in Matthew 7:12, "In everything, therefore, treat people the same way you want them to treat you, for this is the law and the prophets." He is summarizing all of the law. And believe me, that's a lot in Jewish law. You know, they had 613 laws that they recognized from the Old Testament, but that was just the tip of the iceberg. Because what the Pharisees did was say that it is so important not to break a law that we're going to set up hedges or fences around each law so that you'd have to break all of these hedges, all of these little rulets, if you want to call them that, before you actually break the real rule. For instance, the Sabbath simply says, keep holy the Lord's day. Do no kind of work. Don't kindle a fire in your home. That's all that Exodus says about the Sabbath. And yet the Pharisees came up with 39 different, they called them malacha. Malacha were hedges or fences around the concept of the Sabbath that defined what it meant to do servile work. Because all the questions come up. You know, okay, I can't light a fire, but can I use the fire if I lit it the day before? Can I cook a meal on that fire? Can I prepare a meal at all, even if it's cold? Can I take a walk? Can my children play? What if my child falls down and breaks a bone? Can I fix the bone? You know, can I read a book? Can I carry the book from the shelf to my chair? I mean, these sound silly, but when the letter of the law has been divorced from the spirit of the law, the intent of the law, then we're all just looking for loopholes, you know, like W.C. Fields said. And so then the lawyers get involved, and all these things happen to us. You know, our Constitution, our U.S. Constitution, probably has about 5,000 words. Add the amendments, maybe 7,500. How many laws do we have on the books right now? Millions of lines of code. And not just the federal code, but you got each state code that's based on the federal code. And so it goes and it goes and it goes. All of these rules from very simple principles But we have gotten so far away that all we see are the rules now, and we have got forgotten the principles. Jesus is all about bringing us back to the intent, back to the principles. And so we get something like this, which is designed to bring us back to the intent. He says, you know, if you can't remember all 613 laws and all the thousands of malacha, which were then broken down into toledoth, which were then broken down into shavuots, you know, all these different categories, if you can't remember all that, you just remember this. Treat others the way you want to be treated. You've done it. And then what do? We call it the golden rule. Well, now we got to follow this rule. Right? And if you don't, then, okay, now we're right back to square one again. What are we going to do to be able to see that this isn't a rule at all? And in fact, as soon as you see it as a rule, you've lost the concept completely. You know those, any of you learn dancing? My wife wishes I would, but. You saw a movie once? Do you remember? I don't even know if they have them anymore, but I remember my parents once took dancing classes when I was a kid, and I just thought it was hilarious because they got these sheets of paper that actually had the outlines of footprints on the paper. And so you put the paper on the ground, you stood there with your partner, and you put your feet, and then you actually followed the footprints around, and it taught you the box step or the foxtrot or the kumbaya. I don't know. So here are my parents, you know, in the family room. They're doing this robotic mechanical thing and looking at their feet and doing all that. All right. You got that image in your mind? Now compare that to Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers gliding around the dance floor. I mean, imagine Fred Astaire. I mean, he just looked like he was floating on air. And of course, those would say that Ginger Rogers was really greater than him because she did everything backwards and in heels. I mean, you ever heard that one? This is the difference. Are we following rules? How about a paint-by-number kit? Okay, the blue goes there and the burnt umber goes there, and you compare that to Rembrandt or Michelangelo or any of the artists here in this room that have gone so far beyond those kind of rules that they can go right from their head to the canvas, right from your head to the vibrations in the air if you're a musician, right from your head to gliding across the dance floor. This is what Jesus is trying to say. Become Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. Stop following the little pieces of paper on the floor. We have to get past this. If we are ever going to learn to live in kingdom, he tells us at Matthew 5:20, "For I say to you, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven." What was the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees? It's what I just described to you. It was 613 times three other categories of dozens of rules, thousands of rules, so many rules people didn't know what they could do and what they couldn't do. That was the source of the Pharisees' power over the people. They were the arbiters of a person's acceptance to God or not, because they had to come to them to ask them if it was right to do this, if it was wrong to do that. They were the arbiters of the rightness or wrongness, and they held the gate to the Father. And that's why Jesus was so incensed at them. He said, "You won't enter the kingdom, and you won't allow anyone else to enter either, because you keep this in their minds that it's about following rules when it has nothing to do with that. You need to exceed that. It's not about a legal relationship with our God. It's about a love relationship with our God. And that makes all the difference. Because you need to exceed 100% in a love relationship. You give all. You give more than all. You give more than fair. If it's just about fairness with you and your spouse, how far does that get you? You need to go more than fair if you're going to have a successful relationship. This is what Jesus is trying to get across. Yet at the same time, look at that third passage, Matthew 5:17. "Do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass from the law until all is accomplished." Is that confusing? Not really. Because what he's talking about is fulfilling the purpose of the law. The purpose of the law. What was the purpose of the law? The purpose of the law was twofold. The purpose of the law is the same today. Maybe not secular law, but our law. The first purpose was to preserve life, and primarily the life of the group, the life of the family, the clan, the nation of Israel. All of those laws in the Ten Commandments are there to give stability to the group, to give ourselves a safe space where we can grow and learn and do the second purpose of the law, which was to realize the presence of God. They called it Shekinah, the Shekinah glory, the glory that you could actually see palpably around the tent of meeting, around certain people and gatherings. When you think about Israel's laws, think about the dietary laws. There were things you could eat, there were things that you couldn't eat. Some of those preserve life because it's good not to eat pork, especially 4,000 years ago when cooking wasn't the same as it is today, right? So there was wisdom in the laws. But once you had decided what you could eat, you had prepared it according to all of the codes in the law, when you had put on the clothing that was designed by the law, down to the knots on your prayer shawl, when you had said the blessings all during the day, when you had done all of these things, what really it amounts to is that you couldn't take 10 steps as a law-abiding Jew in the first century without being reminded of your God and your God's place in your life. Now, you can look at the law as a huge oppression, and when we Westerners look at the Jewish law, we just think, how ridiculous. But there was beauty in there, because if you followed it with that attitude, then every 10 steps you are being reminded of God's presence in your life. Paul called it praying continuously. It's the same thing. To live continuously with the awareness that God is here, God is present to me. That's what the law does if you do it correctly. It has nothing to do with just following rules. Think of it as a Jell-O mold. Any of you ever made Jell-O in a mold? Maybe it was one of those weird fish things or something. You pour the liquid Jell-O in, it fills the space, you let it sit. Eventually you can pull the mold away, and the Jell-O now has the shape of the mold. In positive. Because what does the mold have to be? The mold has to be a negative space. And we pour in the positive space. And so what God is saying is, if you will follow these precepts, kind of fake it till you make it, put the training wheels on your bike, pour your life into this mold, stay there long enough, and then pull the mold away, and you will look like the law. But positive, not negative. It will be written on your hearts, as it was said in the Old Testament. Because think about the law for a second. The law doesn't tell us what to do, does it? The law tells us what not to do. The law is full of thou shalt nots. The law is a negative, what do you want to say? A negative vision of this final product of us living in kingdom. And so every law that we get on the books is chipping away at our freedoms. And this happens in the United States. It happens around the world. It happens in the secular as well as in religious. In fact, I did a little research here. There are some laws on the books that you can't even believe. Have you ever seen some of these things? Did you know that in Belton, Missouri, it's illegal to throw a football? I got Jeff on the brain. It's illegal to throw a snowball in Belton, Missouri. In New Jersey and Oregon, it's illegal to pump your own gas. In Kern County, California, it's illegal to play bingo while drunk. Now, how do you even come up with something like that? Okay, here's a good one. In Illinois, it's against the law to hunt bullfrogs with a firearm. Don't get caught doing that. In Massachusetts, it's illegal to deface a milk carton. Fairfax, Virginia, the use of pogo sticks is outlawed on city buses. Well, thank God for that. Palm Harbor, Florida, it's illegal to have an artificial lawn. In Massachusetts, it's illegal to wear a goatee in public unless you have paid a special licensing fee. You may not fish in your pajamas in Chicago. In New Jersey, it's against the law to offer a cigarette to a monkey. In Atlanta, Georgia, it's illegal to tie your giraffe to a telephone pole or a street lamp. It's considered a felony in Arizona if you protect yourself from an intruder with any weapon other than one similar to the trespassers. So all of those of you with a four iron under your bed, beware if he shows up with a putter, because you could go to jail. It's illegal to set a mousetrap in California if you don't have a hunting license. Okay? In Arkansas, school teachers who bob their hair are not eligible for a raise. In Los Angeles, a man can legally beat his wife with a leather belt or strap, but the belt can't be wider than 2 inches unless he has his wife's consent to beat her with a wider strap. And consent should be given prior to the beating and preferably in writing. Okay, just so you know that, guys. In Nebraska, if a child burps in church, his parents can be arrested. Also in Nebraska, giving a perm without a license is an offense. And here's the winner for me. Anyone who detonates a nuclear device within the city limits of Chico, California, can be fined $500. Okay. What in the world is going on here? Now, obviously, we've got some pretty whacked out elected officials, obviously. But every one of these started with a purpose. And the purpose at some crazy point, with someone who wasn't being able to see the forest for the trees anymore, they were trying to protect something. They were trying to protect the public welfare. They were trying to protect something else, wildlife, you name it. They're trying to protect something. And now we've got all these crazy laws on the book. You know, when I grew up 40 years ago, we didn't have any of the safety laws that we have today. You know, Marion tells a story about bouncing around in the back of whatever Chevy her parents drove with all the windows up and her father smoking a cigar on the sofa seat without any seat belts at age 4 or 5. You know, today you would get pulled over and they would throw away the key if they saw you driving like that. We've got seatbelt laws. We've got helmet laws. We've got smoking laws that are so restrictive now that you can't even smoke outside, let alone inside. We've got laws against the perfume that you wear, right? Now they're starting to write laws against fatty foods, protect you from yourself and from McDonald's. You know, you can't do that. A friend of mine was railing about the Patriot Act a few days ago because President Bush signed with executive order and just wiped out all our Fourth Amendment freedoms against illegal search and seizure in the effort to make us safer from terrorism. And then we haven't even got into taxes yet. You're taxed from the moment that you wake up to the moment you put your head down, and then while you sleep, your utilities are taxed, and your gas is taxed, and your sales are taxed, your income is taxed. And all of those taxes are going toward, hopefully at least, the public infrastructure. So that we do have trash that's actually picked up, and we have street lights, and we don't have too many potholes, and we can call 911, and the fire department will come, and the police will come. All of these hedges against the risks in life is what we trade for freedom with all the laws that we create. In another life, and whenever I say that, I don't mean a reincarnated life. Just a while back, I used to work in the printing industry. And in the printing industry, we had an adage. And the adage was price, quality, or speed. Pick any two. Get that? You're not going to ever get all three. You know, if you want it to be a low price and you want it to be a high quality, then you're going to have to wait for it. When they get around to it, then they'll get to it. But if speed is your highest priority and you want quality, then you're going to have to pay for that, you know? So you can pick any two, but you never get all three. And so here, we can have security or we can have freedom, but we can't have both. When you think about it, to be free is to be completely alone. To be completely free is to be completely alone. Every time that we bring another person into our life, we limit our freedoms voluntarily for that relationship. If you have a husband or a wife and you feel perfectly free to do whatever you want, whenever you want, you're not going to have a husband or a wife very much longer. Let me tell you. We voluntarily limit our freedoms. The law limits our freedoms in order for us to live as a society. We give up our freedoms in order to have some sense of security against risk. We know that if we don't steal, they can't steal against us. So we feel more secure with our belongings, even though we are limited in our freedom. And so we are making this choice back and forth. And the law always does this. It always restricts. Okay? It always limits our freedoms. But Jesus said, if you follow my ways, if you follow my commands, then you will be truly my follower. And if you're my follower, you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. How does that work? If we are following commands, and we are voluntarily limiting our freedom, how do we become free? See, this is one of the paradoxes that Jesus is trying to get across to us. It happens when we break through from printed footprints on a piece of paper to gliding across a dance floor. When we break through from just following rules to loving someone so much that we are no longer following rules, but we automatically look like those rules. We become those rules as we lose ourselves in relationship with the other. This is what Jesus is trying to get across to us. How much time do I have? You know, some of you know that when I left high school, I entered a monastery. And it was the same teaching order, the same religious order that taught me at a Catholic high school that I went to. And it was at a time in my life when I didn't have a lot of mentors. My father and I, you know, were kind of aloof from each other. I didn't have him to go to. And these brothers meant so much to me. I could throw rocks at Brother Ski's window at 2 in the morning, and he'd come down and talk to me, and did. And that meant the world to me. And I wanted to be able to do that for somebody else, especially for high school boys. And this was a teaching order. So I left, and I flew to Chicago. And here I was, an 18-year-old who had spent the entire summer on the beach, barefoot, body surfing, doing whatever I did, hair down to my shoulders, and trying to then fit into a religious order, into a house of formation that was in the middle of a cornfield in Lockport, Illinois, right next to the Joliet State Penitentiary. I'd never seen cornfields before. I had no idea that there were actually red barns and silos outside of a picture book. I couldn't believe it. I remember just riding my bike around in those fields and looking around. It's just like a storybook existence. Everything was so foreign to me. The first morning after I arrived late on the plane. I had been up practically the entire night, and I stumbled into the chapel for morning mass in jeans that were covered with macrame. Now, those of you who have lived through the early 70s, you know what macrame is. Back in the hippie days, everything was macrame. You couldn't even see any blue denim anymore on these jeans. They were completely covered with butterflies and all these just different patterns and sayings. You know, probably the peace sign was in there someplace, I imagine. American flag, you know, kind of embroidered in there. So I walk into chapel with those jeans on and a baseball jersey and bare feet. I didn't last 2 seconds in that room before I was sent back out again, and I had to get properly attired. Then came all the rules. And here I was, 18 years old, and if you don't know this about me either, I sort of had an authority complex growing up, so I didn't take to rules very lightly, and especially rules that made absolutely no sense to me, and that seemed completely arbitrary. And we had all these rules. Whenever we were inside, we always had to wear shoes and socks. I had spent 90% of my existence in bare feet, and so I had to wear now shoes and socks. We had a dress code that we had to follow all the time, you know, and we had to be completely covered and this and that. We had chores that we had to do. We had TV time that was allotted to us. There was only one room that had a TV in it, and they sort of had these seating, and I think it was 2 or 3 nights a week. We had 1 or 2 hours where we could actually watch TV. But then you had to vote on which program that you were going to watch. And you have to remember, there was 10 of us, 18-year-olds and 17-year-olds there, but then there was a bunch of brothers that had been kind of sent there to pasture, so they're 60 and 70, and a couple of them were in their early 80s, and they got a vote too. So we rarely got to watch what we wanted to watch, you know, and it was just all these rules, and I just, you know, bristled at them. And so I was always, then we had lights out time, of course, at like 9 o'clock, which drove me crazy. And so we were pushing the envelope on all these things, but I was sort of the ringleader. And so we'd be staying up late, and I could look down the hallway, and I could see Brother Dalton, who was the novice master. I could see his shadow on the side, right behind the firewall that was halfway through the building. And so I knew he knew that we were up, and he was listening to us, but he didn't come down and do anything. He kind of let us do this for a while. Then he instituted a new rule. There was no napping in the afternoon. Smart, huh? So, trying to tire us out, you know. And then with the socks and shoes thing, I'd always go into cafeteria for dinner, and I'd show up in my bare feet, and he'd send me back out and say, you have to have shoes and socks. Then I'd put my shoes on, but without socks, of course, and you couldn't see because I had my jeans on. And then he got to the point where he would look under the table, make sure I had my socks on. If I didn't, he'd send me back out. So one time I came back in with my socks over my shoes, because of course he didn't tell me what order I had to wear socks and shoes. I just had to wear socks and shoes, you know. And then as far as the jeans were concerned, since he hated those jeans, but they sort of fell into the dress code, I wore them practically every day until the right leg was ripping more and more and more, and finally it entirely fell off. And I wore it that way for 4 more days, with one leg off and one leg on, until he finally told me I couldn't wear those anymore. And so, you know, it was kind of a one flew over the cuckoo's nest kind of existence where, you know, I was just always pushing it and pushing it. And then there was one day where things came to a head. I was in my room laying on the bed, and there was a bunch of guys in there, and someone flipped the lights on and off in the hallway, and I shouted out some kind of sarcastic thing about who's messing with the lights. And, of course, it was Brother Dalton, and he had just about had it with me. And he was an ex-wrestling coach. So he takes one step into the door and jumps with both knees on my chest, knocks all the wind out of me, flips me around, puts me in a half Nelson, and he's screaming in my ear. And, of course, everybody else is in shock, and I really couldn't even hear what he was saying to me because I couldn't breathe. You know, he just lost it. This is your pastor speaking. Nice, huh? And this is in a religious order. You know, it boggles the mind. You know, but what happens when you take a bunch of 17 and 18-year-olds from all across the country and you put them into this foreign situation? You know, and you're trying to get them to live together. We had one kid from Hawaii. He came from Damien High School in Molokai. And he grew up on a commune. And so for him, marijuana was just the way of life. He had his parents and friends shipping him marijuana to the monastery, and he thought there was nothing wrong with it. It's just the way he lived, you know. And so all of these things are happening. And finally, after that one incident with Brother Dalton, he called me into his office and he sat me down and he said, you know, I can't let you win, because if you win, I lose all those other guys. And then I got it. I understood why the rules were there. The rules were there not to torment us, not to break our spirit. The rules were there to teach us how to live in community with each other. You know, wherever I went, if I had stayed in that order, I would have been living in a community house on the property of a school somewhere in North America with a bunch of brothers of all ages from all around the world, some of them directly from Ireland, in their 80s, 70s, 60s, 20s. How do you get that kind of disparate group to live together? You create a common ground. You create a common bond. You know, it's just like boot camp in the military. You create a playing field in which everyone can be secure. And I'll tell you what, it wasn't until I started to love my brothers that the rules made any sense. But when I loved my brothers enough, the rules weren't necessary anymore. I just did it. And I didn't feel put upon. I felt actually freer because I wasn't always thinking about all this stuff. You know? The things that are the most free in life are the things you don't think about at all. Right? The things that you're thinking about constantly are the things that enslave you, the things that bind you, the things that you lay awake at night and stare at the ceiling about. Those are the things that own you. The things that are truly free, we just don't think about. And when I stopped thinking about the rules because I was just living them, that was the breakthrough. That's what Jesus is talking about. That's what he's trying to get us to see. Stop thinking about right and wrong. Stop thinking about a bookkeeper God who is keeping some sort of ledger open on you. It's not like that. The law is there to teach you how to live in community. But once you learn the lesson, once you care about the people in community, you don't need the rules anymore. You can just flow across the dance floor, and you can make music like you never believed. Yesterday, Marion and I were watching television, and an old movie was on, a Turner Classic or whatever, and it was Harvey. Any of you remember the movie Harvey with James Stewart? Old black and white movie, and James Stewart plays Elwood P. Dowd, who is just this kind of touched in the head man who goes around town just enjoying everything and everybody, and he's just easygoing, and he's driving his sister nuts because he won't do the things that she wants him to do in the house, and he won't, submit to the responsibilities and the things she wants him to do. So finally she hatches this plot to try to have him committed because she thinks he's completely crazy, because on top of everything else, he thinks he sees a 6-foot rabbit. You know, and he calls him Harvey, and he has conversations with him, and he travels with him wherever he goes. You know, when he goes into the bar, Harvey's with him. When he goes to visit someone, Harvey's with him. And so everybody thinks he's nuts. But there was something about him that caught everyone's attention as well. And I put a couple of quotes from Harvey, and these two scenes just jumped out at me. And there's this one scene where he's at the psychiatric hospital where he's been brought by his sister for commitment. And the head psychiatrist is talking to him, Dr. Chumley, and he says, "This sister of yours is at the bottom of a conspiracy against you. She's trying to persuade me to lock you up. Today she had commitment papers drawn up, she has your power of attorney and the key to your safety box, and she brought you here." And Elwood says, with admiration in his voice, "She did all that in one afternoon? That Vita certainly is a whirlwind now, isn't she? Good heavens, man, haven't you got any righteous indignation?" And he says, "Oh, doctor, you know, years ago my mother used to say to me, she'd say, in this world, Elwood," she always used to call me Elwood, "in this world, Elwood, you must be oh so smart or oh so pleasant." Well, for years I was smart. I recommend pleasant. You may quote me. I don't do justice to it. You got to hear Jimmy Stewart deliver that. But it was so perfect. We can be oh so smart. We can follow all those rules, but I recommend pleasant. I recommend just living your life in connection with each other and forgetting about the rules, because the rules are written into the heart of who we are as people, who we are in relationship with each other. And then at the end, he says, "Did I tell you Harvey could stop clocks?" Well, you've heard the expression, "His face could stop a clock." Well, Harvey can look at your clock and stop it. And you can go anywhere you like, with anyone you like, and stay as long as you like. And when you get back, not 1 minute will have ticked by. And of course, Dr. Chumley asked the obvious question, "Well, where did you go?" "Well, nowhere. There wasn't anywhere I wanted to go. I always have a wonderful time wherever I am, with whomever I'm with." Can you imagine to have the genie that would let you go anywhere you want, as long as you want, with anyone you wanted to, and have nowhere else you would rather be than right here, right now? That is what kingdom looks like. That is who we can be. That wherever we are is the most important place on earth. Whoever we are with is the most important person on earth. If we will just stop following rules and see the person we're with, see the world that we inhabit, find the Spirit of God in that moment, and there will be nowhere else we'll want to be. Let's pray. Father, it is so simple, and it is so difficult. Help us in the difficulty of being able to put down all the things we think we know. Help us to break through the limits of the wells that we inhabit. Help us to be able to see you in every smile, in every face, in every set of eyes that we look into. Help us to see you in the mountains and the scenery that we pass without thinking every day. Help us to see you in our jobs, how that the work we do affects the others that we are around. And if we do it well, and if we can do it with a sense of your presence and your assistance each moment, that we can be the kind of person that lights up our offices and our places of employment, lights up our classrooms, lights up our homes. Help us to be those people, Lord. Help us to begin to live kingdom by looking like the law without following any rules. We know that we can do this, Lord, because you showed us. You showed us in your Son, and he told us that these things that you see me do, you can do, and greater things than these, So it is possible, Father. Help us to get there a little bit more each day. And we thank you from the bottom of our hearts in the name of Jesus, in his essence, in his character, and in his love. Amen. Amen. Let's all stand.